Coming back.
One arm on the wheel, holding my lover with the other. A sweet, soft, southern thrill. I worked hard all week, got a little jingle on a Tennessee Saturday night. No, I couldn't feel better, 'cause I'm together with my Dixieland delight. Spend my dollar.
All right. Here we are. It's 4:30 on my birthday. No, I think we've done about 3 hours of radio so far. So nothing wild. You know, I took a beer collection / burrito break here. Took an eating break earlier. Last year I learned my mistake. I barely ate anything. Had trouble making it through the day. So this year, and last year was 7 hours. This is 12. But we're back. We're back in action. So I did travel. You know, as always, I always have a, long travel complaint when I get back from traveling somewhere. Now, don't mistake this. You know, I understand that not everyone gets to travel, that this is a lucky position to be in, right? Oh, you get to travel. That's a really good thing. It is good. But there are things about it that are frustrating. You know, first thing is, you know, is packing. And after I got there, I realized that I may have to make part of my regular packing for vacations to be a nose hair trimmer, you know. In case I didn't feel like I was getting to be a crazy, weird old man, this is something I need now, is a nose hair trimmer. I have the worst body and face hair of all time. Where is it located, you ask? Oh, well, let's see. Primarily butt, lower legs, neck, nose, and in between the eyebrows and amongst the eyebrows. That is where 90% of my body hair is located. Okay? You know, the hairs just grow out of the nose, and I feel like, you know, they won't stop. I have this memory in school of a teacher telling me about, you know, world record for growing the longest hair, and how someone can do this record, but you can't, there's not an infinite hair length. You know, everyone's got like a genetic built-in crash point here. Hang on a second, we got a real problem brewing that I need to sort out. Oh, Jesus, all right. This is the worst show, you guys. Happy birthday to me, this is the worst show. Okay, I think we've got things worked out satisfactorily. To my satisfaction, goddammit. I can get my satisfaction, and here it is. We did this. So, you know, it's just, it's a real sad situation for me. You know, feel bad for me, guys. My body hair. Feel horrible for me. Isn't it awful? You know, I guess you could look at it as someone has it worse, but I don't think it's true. I don't think anyone, no matter what their affliction, has it worse than me and my nose hair. Here's what's hard about nose hairs, too. Nose hair trimmer is a pretty great invention. You could pluck them, but fuck does that hurt, man. You know, just recently got into the eyebrow plucking field because I felt like razors not cutting it, really. They grow back too fast. And also, it's hard to do even, you know. And I have hairs that grow in amongst the eyebrow hairs that are 4 times as long as the other eyebrow hairs. Can't get you have to pull them out. A nose hair is moist and it's inside. It's very, you cannot pull it out. Eyebrow hair, if I can, you know, it's almost long enough that I could get it wrapped. Or if I had a toothpick, I could easily wrap it around a toothpick and just yank it out. No problem. I can almost get it around a finger far enough to give me the leverage. But man, nose hair, that hurts. that you do not want to pull that shit out. So, you know, I don't know the airport. Okay, remember that movie, The Terminal, with Tom Hanks, where he's like a weird foreign guy and he gets stuck in the... Let's look at the trailer for The Terminal here. When I was a kid, I saw this movie, and this guy gets stuck in an airport. I don't know. Is this a narration trailer? Maybe it'll tell us the whole story. Some foreign guy gets stuck in a... I'm just looking at a airport. It's busy. People going place to place. The little boards.
Mr. Navarsky, please follow me.
While you were in the air,
you just arrived in New York.
Coup in your country.
Republic of Krakosia is under new leadership.
Krakosia.
I don't think he gets it.
Where do I buy the Nike shoes?
I'm gonna need the passport also. No, Mr. Navorsky, beyond those doors is American soil. You are not to leave this building.
So he's, for now, he must live in the terminal. So he's laying on chairs, he's rearranging chairs,
showering.
I think it's CIA.
You don't know what the hell you're talking about. That guy doesn't even speak English.
I help you.
Do you live nearby?
Trying to get a job.
Gate 67.
Because we are very particular about punctuality. Did you say gate 67?
We don't play for cash. We play for unclaimed items from the lost and found.
Who, he meets a woman?
She's a wild stallion. You help me to win her heart and you'll never go home again.
He meets an attractive sort of Tandy Newton looking woman.
What? Like a horse.
Stand behind the O-line.
I think that might be a Zoe Saldana.
Opa, this belong you.
Thanks.
Oh, now he meets Catherine Zeta-Jones, flight attendant, I guess. Jesus.
We headed for home?
No, I am delayed a long time.
Oh, now we get this music. Jesus.
You are the kind of woman who can get any guy she wants. Why Victor Navorsky?
That's something a guy like you could never understand.
Oh, we have the Indian guy from the Wes Anderson movies who like got in trouble for beating his wife or something. The Terminal.
You ever feel like you're just living in an airport?
Just frozen staring in the mirror. So, this was a movie I saw as a child. Now, I mean, it was kind of boring. But, you know, my overall feeling was kind of like, I don't know, that wouldn't be so bad. When you're a kid, your life is not that different. Or, you know, I don't know, I'm 14 maybe. It's not that different from living in an airport terminal, because you really have no control. You're just going to, you know, all I could think of when I was a kid was, if I'm not going to school, I'm happy. That's all I really wanted out of life. What, do I have to be in school if I'm living in the terminal, trapped for life, and maybe they're going to murder me? I don't have to go to school. Okay, I'm in. Let's do it. Where do we go? Where's the terminal? How do we get terminaled here? I would have been in. You know, but that's just because... I mean, yeah, also if you were in hell for eternity and they said, well, you could go live in the terminal instead, you'd be like, oh, okay, well, let's do the terminal. Let's do the terminal thing. So, it didn't seem that bad, but in reality, the reality of living in the terminal, of being in the terminal, because that's what it feels like. I think that, you know, the person who came up with that movie probably was just thinking how it feels, you know, was like this fat dope shaving in the mirror at the airport, like, doesn't it feel like you live in the airport? And he's just like, it does. Why? It does. And then he decided to make a movie. So, the airport. Now, I had to wake up. I had a flight at 8:30 in the morning. Now, 8:30 in the morning, that doesn't sound like an early... Here's how time works for me. I consider something at 8 a.m. to not be really early. You know, once a week I have to be at work at 8 a.m. That's not a big deal. 9, not early. 9's good. 10 is perfect. If I have to be somewhere at 10, that's ideal. And so on. Now, moving the other way, 7. This is when we start to get into early territory. You know, someone says, we got to be there at 7. I go, oof. All right. All right, but I'm not happy. You know, I wish this was not the case. I wish murder was not the case they gave me here. You know, or then we get to six. Now you're just, six is where you're getting into crazy territory. Right? That's when you're on the verge of way too early. Like, if people are regularly waking up at six for no reason, that's when I start to think, okay, this person's insane. Obviously insane. Five is when you are just out of your fucking mind. You must be a farmer, which, by the way, I still think they're idiots. What's the difference? You have headlights on that tractor. Just do it at night. Who cares? You work whenever the fuck you want. But to get to an 8:30 flight, which is a reasonable time, I have to get up at 4:30 in order to quickly get ready and drive to the airport, which doesn't take all that long. And then, you know, be there 2 hours early, standing in line, basically prepare for... So the whole day, no matter how quickly you travel, you know, it takes about an hour to get to the airport each way. That means I have a 7 hour travel day, you know, from doorstep to doorstep. If I'm going on like a 2.5 hour flight, a 2.5 hour flight is a 7 hour day of travel. I mean, that seems out of proportion, doesn't it? So, you know, I just, how fucking early do you have to get up? No one should have to get up. You know, that's a red eye, by the way. That should be a red eye. 8:30, I know they wouldn't call it a red eye, but they should say, oh, well, this motherfucker is going to get up 4 hours after he went to bed. That's, in a way, a red eye. So I get up, you know, I get to the plane, I make it. You know, and here's the other thing. I get up at 4:30, and still on the way to the airport, there's an intensity of, ah, shit, you know, I'm looking at the clock every 10 minutes to be like, how am I doing? Am I getting good? You know, and I get in a line of traffic a couple miles from the airport, and we're going 10 below the limit, and I'm starting to scream in the car. You know, you shouldn't, if you're getting up at 4:30 for something, that should be, you should be comfortable, right? That should be like, I read the paper, I made Belgian waffles myself, I bought a waffle maker, made the waffles, didn't like how they turned out, made a second batch that was better. But no, it's just enough time to panically get to your plane. So they do this too. This is the newest trick in the airport, by the way. They have a new scheme that they do at security. This has happened the last 4 times I've flown. I've never heard this before, but here's what they'll do. You'll get in line at the security, the main security, and some guy standing there will be like, you know what? The line at the other end, way shorter. There's a security at this other terminal, and then you can just walk to this terminal. It is so much shorter. First time that happened in Denver, I was like, right on. You know, I don't mind the walk. I'll walk over. Walk over. The line is twice as long, and there's half as many people working there. Basically, this guy was full of shit. I don't know if he was misinformed or full of shit at this time, but I think, ah, shit, you know. And I think you're tricked into thinking, oh, it was short, but by the time I got here, now it's long, you know. However, this happened again. The next time I got home, I was flying home, they said the same thing, and I was like, go fuck yourself. I ain't changing lines. But then, flying out from Denver, they did it again. You know, you have to go down the escalator to the security, and they have a huge main security area, and they have the smaller terminal. The lady was standing at the top of the escalator saying, line's way shorter down there, if you want to head down there. And I was just like, no thanks, and just walked right past her. Because I said, last time, even if the line would have to be non-existent to be as quick as this other line. And go fuck yourself. You know? What do I care? So I get down there, go through. You know, it's all good. I just, you know, but then on the way back from Portland, they did the same thing. This was the first non-Denver, you know, they were, this is one of the first non-Denvers, I guess. Half the time, oof, guys, I'm losing it. They tried to do the same thing there, and I just said, I'm not falling for that ever again. They were going to have to escort me to that line physically and say, you cannot come this way. It's faster the other way. You know, the last thing you want is like the B team doing your shit. So I get on the plane, you know, and I'm sitting there just waiting to see who comes in. And turns out to be this woman, and she's got 2 children with her. Now I'm sitting in the window seat, And her and one of her kids, she's in the, you know, middle seat, or the kid is, and she's on the aisle, and her other kid's sitting across the aisle. So, of course, partway through the flight, or no, I'm sorry, the kid's sitting in the middle on the other side. Which I was like, that's a weird setup. You know, some other person's going to sit in the seat, then the kid in the middle, then someone else, you know, so the kid's isolated from the mom. That's a strange way to fly. But whatever. So then the mom says to me, would you mind switching seats so we could sit together? Now, I don't really like to sit in the middle. I read this thing. Here's the one thing. You're most likely to survive a crash in the middle. I don't know, because the side, I guess you're least likely to get out of the aisle when it's full of smoke and everyone, you know, people can't even get out of the aisle when they have not crashed, when they've landed properly and the lights are on. So I can imagine if it was dark and smoking and panicked, everyone just dies. In the aisle, you're likely to get hit with bags and shit, like all the things bust open and you just get bludgeoned by a bag. So in the center is your best chance for survival. So that's the one solace I take, although part of me thinks, I don't know, it's not like you hear about a plane crash and it's like, well, half the people lived. It's usually like, well, there were no survivors, or everyone was pretty much fine. There's like one old woman who broke her pelvis. But I said, all right, you know, I felt for him. And honestly, I was like, well, this isn't going to be peaceful for anyone to have this one kid across the aisle. I mean, she was like, well, we didn't get to pick our, you know, I'm sorry, we didn't get to pick our seats, you know, which I said in my head. I was like, well, if you check in online 24 hours early, which you should fucking do if you're planning on flying with kids and you'd like to sit next to each other. But anyway, I switch over. Well, it turns out, motherfucking the dad is the one sitting in the aisle on the other side, which I didn't know. I don't know where this asshole was. You know, I had assumed it was a mom and two kids, but it was a mom and a kid and a dad and a kid. So the dad would have been next to the kid and the mom would have been next to the other kid. And instead I switched seats, sitting in a shitty middle seat next to this fat dad who's encroaching on the armrests and shit the whole time, in order for them to sit two kids with the mom and then the dad just to have his own aisle seat in the island, and they could just like yell at each other across the aisle for the entire flight. It was beautiful. It was really worth it. I felt very tricked. You know, I feel like she snaked me by pretending like the dad wasn't coming. You know what I mean? She didn't say anything to the daughter like, your dad's coming or whatever. Pissed me off. So then, also, I mean, everybody on this plane, this was like the most snackingest plane I've ever seen. This is a 2-hour plane drive. I get it, you know, eat some food. That's cool. This dad had like Cheetos in a plastic bag, then a plastic bag of gummy bears, I don't know, oatmeal or some shit. There were like 9 plastic bags. He stuffed the entire seat back in front of him with other plastic bags, and they didn't even eat any of it, by the way. What the fuck? This is like, this is for me, like when you see someone jogging, they're on a 20-minute jog and they have a 2-liter water bottle they're carrying. It's like, I think you can make it 20 minutes without drinking that water. You'll be okay. You'll be better off. You know, instead of jogging carrying 10 pounds, how about you just jog and then drink the water? Drink some water before you go and then drink some extra when you get back. It's going to be okay. Same thing for a 2-hour flight. Bring a 12-ounce water. You don't need to bring a goddamn camel back. However, the snacks didn't end there. The woman, I was sitting next to this old woman. She looked kind of like a retired music teacher or something like that. Sweater. She had one of those weird hairy sweaters that looked so uncomfortable to the touch. And so I think that's like old lady armor. They wear these rough outer, the outer part of the sweater is rough. So when you touch it, it's, you know, bristly against your fingertips. I think that's how they protect themselves, you know, for whatever they're protecting themselves from. She brought 2 snacks as well. So the plane takes off, and we experienced some of the most intense turbulence in my life. I talked about it with my mom. You know, we would just be going. I was sort of asleep, and we would just drop 5 feet, you know, straight down, hit a pocket, drop straight down. This happened several times. You know, and shit's rattling and shaking and stuff. You're just like, okay. So this woman next to me during this whole event, you know, pulls out a pancake. She, in a plastic bag, she has a single pancake with 3 pieces, like 3 slabs of butter on top of it, arranged in a triangle pattern. This is her plain snack, is a pancake with unmelted slabs of butter on it. And she held it, you know, it was like a disc, a hard disc. It wasn't a floppy pancake. So she held it with her fingers all below it. Trying to think, you know, like an artist holds their paint palette. Do people use that, by the way? I love how that's like a classic art thing. Oh, it's this paint palette. You can put your thumb through it. Oh, it's a piece of fucking wood with paint on it. Big fucking deal. You know, the big innovation in that was like, oh, we can make these little cups for the paint to go. Oh, good for you. What a big improvement to the life of art. Good job. So she's holding it like that, you know, like it's, I don't know, this precious object. Eating this pancake. So she eats this pancake. And she's got something else on her lap. And I couldn't tell what, I thought it was more butter. I thought it was just slabs of butter in a bag. I'm thinking, my God, you know, it's in this plastic grocery bag, like the kind you get vegetables and shit in. And it's all clouded from what's inside. And she's just holding it in her lap, cooking it. I'm thinking, this butter is going to be all melted, lady. What are you doing? And there was a weird smell coming from it cooking in her old woman lap. So at one point she opens the bag and the smell is like old milk or something. And I see a label and it is 1.6 pounds of cheese curds in a bag. Now, I think on the airplane I'm more polite than most. I come on here and subject everyone else to it, to the complaints. But on the plane, you would like to sit next to me on the plane, believe me. As long as you're not afraid that me wearing my headphones during takeoff is going to crash the plane, I'm your ideal seat partner. I hate encroaching over the barrier. I'll probably just sleep the whole time. I'll probably do some hilarious fall asleep, head falls forward, wake up things. I don't get drinks. I don't pass trash out. I just fucking sit there. You know, I'm not getting up to go pee. There are certain things that are appropriate, you know, even within my boundaries. I think that I'm pretty cool with people eating anything, but I think there are certain things not appropriate to eat on the plane. You do not get the tuna sub from the Quiznos in the airport immediately before getting on the airplane. You just don't. You don't need to. Have a cup of coffee. What are you going to do? You know, that's something that people are going to have and they're going to need. Tuna sub, I'd say, well, just have something else. Have turkey. Have chicken salad. Let's fucking not do the tuna. Cheese curds is another snack that I did not think would have to be officially added to this list, as I'm not entirely sure where one purchases these in this state. Now, maybe she was flying through from the Midwest. That's all I could think of. She's from Wisconsin. She got some at the grocery store on the way. I picture in Wisconsin, you go in a grocery store or a gas station. They've got scratch-offs. And normally where we have beef sticks, they've just got do you fill your own bag with one of those little metal shovels of cheese curds? And how many pounds of cheese curds do you need? 1.16 or like 0.16? If you've ever bought a pound, I bought a pound of turkey. 7.75 pounds of turkey at the store. That's a lot. That would be hard to eat in a flight. You know, you just have this lump. This is cheese curds. Old cheese. So, you know, I'm sitting next to this woman who's just eating, heating up old cheese in her lap for the entire flight. It's very nice. You know, we're going through this turbulence, and then that's when they're doing the thing to, like, tell me, oh, get one of our frequent mileage cards. That'll improve your, you know. Like, could you wait till I feel like I might die to finish doing this, to sell me on this card? Like, normally I just ignore this, and right now it's taken on a real bitter, bitter flavor. And also, I think you should get like a free drink or something if that happens. I mean, I feel like if you know, the bus crashed into a pylon at the pier or something, maybe you should get a free bus ride, right? I'm not asking for a free plane ride because it was turbulent, but a nice beverage wouldn't hurt, wouldn't kill you. Fucking water, for God's sake. Oh, they also had my favorite thing at the airport. Come up the escalator, they got this goddamn motorcycle that you can enter to win. Same Honda Shadow has been there since 1999. I shit you not. Just sitting there, someone's just polishing it. How did they even get it in there? I never understood this. Like, when they have cars, they'd always have cars sitting in the middle of the mall. Which I like that, as if, you know, you're like, well, it wasn't really... Who is not planning to buy a car and then sees one at the mall and is like, yeah, maybe I'll get one of those. Car, eh? This is not the piercing pagoda where you could pay $12 and then have your ears pierced. It was like a lifetime monetary commitment. Yet, here we are. Anyway, I don't know. People who, I don't know what happens. You must enter to win that motorcycle and they just give your email address away to the worst people on the planet. Just to make you miserable. To make you want to die more than you've ever wanted anything. The flight back wasn't too bad. There were two airport run-ins, though, that I didn't care for. So I go to check my bag. By the way, check your fucking bag, people. If everyone, you have to pay now to put your bag overhead or check it. Just check it. Or check it at the gate so it goes down below. You know why? Me waiting for you to handle your bag is destroying my life. You know, this is the thing, too, that happens. Like my mom was saying on the earlier thing, you just got to be zen, you know? You got to just let things pass and let it go. I don't understand why it's up to me to let everything go if everyone could just spend 2 minutes thinking about courtesy and, you know, not being a dildo and thinking about, I can't even lift this over my head. Why am I carrying it on the plane? You carry on the things on the plane that you cannot lose. And how much stuff is that? Bring your phone. Bring your iPod. Bring your cheese curds. Let the rest just hang, you know? You'll be okay. What if you don't get it for 4 hours? You'll be fine. I don't know. I do. There's that moment of panic. Like, I hate if you're sitting on the seat watching them load the bags. Because then you're always watching for your bag, and if you don't see it, you're like, oh, shit. I didn't see it. Granted, I only saw them load 8 bags, but I did not see mine. So on the way back, I'm checking my bag, and I go up, and the lady says, can I see your ID? And I give it to her. And she says, this doesn't look like you. And I said, okay, you know, really? And she says, yeah. She says, you know, your hair is different. I had this weird, crazy long hair when I got my ID. And the other lady looks at it and she's like, no, it's not the hair. It's because you're not smiling. You know? Which I was like, fair enough. But I mean, I'm about to, you know, just go in another hell plane and just be miserable. So I don't know. Yeah, when I got that ID, that was when I got my motorcycle license. I was in a jovial mood. You know, I was moving up in the world. Now I'm going back home. I don't want to go there. I don't want to go back to work, and I just don't want to be alive. So the smile had faded. So since those days, I don't know, the last 5 years, I've lost my smile. But I appreciated them pointing that out, you know. Oh, you seem much sadder. You have a deep internal sadness that I don't think you had when you got this picture. Oh, really? Thank you. That was really nice of you to say that. Then I had another, so I go through the security, and I go in that whirly tube thing, and it picked out spots on my back, you know, and the guy said, oh, hold up here for a second, sir. And then he just points to the monitor, and he's like, see where this picked up perspiration on your back? There are these yellow rectangles, you know, around, I guess, my sweatiest spots in my back, which is my whole back. And I just was like, you know that's perspiration. Why do you got to stop me and let me know? Sir, are you aware your back's sweaty? Yeah, I am. I've been aware that my back has been sweaty for the last 15 years, nonstop. Okay? Here's a questionnaire to figure out is Pete's back sweaty. Question 1, is he still alive? Okay, done. So it's nice of him to stop and let me know how his marvelous machine worked. And that, you know, I was exhibiting sweat behavior. So So, you know, that was the travels and travails. I did, I went to the workshop there. I don't know. I could talk about that. That's like its whole own thing, though. That's like one of those Tinder shows. I don't know. I could do a Tinder show in about an hour until our next guests arrive. Or we could do something less Tinder. Let's see. Let me see if I have something I really wanted to get to. Well, I think we could either call Comcast or do this. Those seem like the best options to me. I mean, I should probably just do this while it's fresh in my mind, right? I just bookended it with the travel. So here's the thing that I ended up doing. Hang on one second. I'm going to grab this. Grab this book back here. So anyone who knows me for a while knows about my love for the good old Chuck Palahniuk, writer of Fight Club, amongst many others. His writing teacher was this man named Tom Spanbauer, who I read his books based on him being Chuck Palahniuk's teacher, and completely fell in love with them. They are great. You know, I would highly recommend to anyone that you read one of his books. You know, try Far Away Places. It's short. It's quick. You'll find if you really enjoy it, I think. So I decided to, you know, Val, who will be here in a little while, let me know that Tom Spanbauer was doing one of his dangerous writing workshops. You know, which is what Chuck Palahniuk talked about all the time. That's where he started, you know, and a lot of the things, the ways he writes and the things he does are based on a lot of that. So I said, holy shit, this is a rare opportunity. I could go meet my favorite writer, Tom Spanbauer. I could sit at the table where Chuck Palahniuk was sitting, you know, when he came up with these crazy ideas and wrote these books that touched my life, right? So I said, okay, this sounds pretty good. So I decided to sign up for the workshop and go there. So we had an assignment. We had an assignment to write about something. 2 to 3 pages, double-spaced. You had to write about a time that everything you thought changed. You know, you were going one way, and then all of a sudden you're going the other way. So it's a fiction writing workshop, but you're supposed to write about your real life getting going. So, sorry guys, I'm trying to flip through to find this thing that's really important for later. About this guy getting shot in his big fat heart. So, I'm sorry, this is terrible radio here. Hit the guy climbing the stairs. This is really important when I can get to you here, but who knows if I can get there, right? Jesus. What a horrible thing you guys listen to. Thanks for listening to this. I guess this is my sort of self-indulgent birthday thing, huh? Okay, let's just get to it. I'm going to stop looking at this. In like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1-ish, almost 1. Okay, I can't do this. Anyway, I go to this thing, right? And I work on the assignment feverishly. You know, I do like 10 drafts of this 2 to 3 pages over and over, do the best I can. And I get into Portland on Friday, and, you know, I have to journey out to this house. So I figure, well, I got to be there at 10 a.m. Again, that's not super early, but early. So what I should do is go out there, find exactly where I need to go, and because then I can just retrace the steps tomorrow, and I know how long it'll take. So I go out there, I find the house. There's this gate in the backyard, you know, and it's this wrought iron thing, and it's all decorated, and It says TS on it for Tom Spanbauer. So I go to take a picture of it, and he comes out from the side of the house. You know, I don't know if he saw me taking a picture or not, but he was there, and he says, like, hello, and I say hi. And, you know, part of me was like, should I tell him in the workshop? But I was like, I don't know, that's awkward. It was very awkward. You know, I wish I had just taken the picture and move on. Or not taking the picture would have been really smart. But, you know, really smart is out the window. So I go back the next morning, you know, nervous as fuck. And I go down, it's in his basement of his house. You know, it's at this big table, and there's all this stuff in the middle of the table. There's, like, liquor bottles. There's a bunch of little penises. He was saying that only straight men have ever given him penises, but he's got a bunch of them from straight men. You know, there were pens and cups. There was all kinds of shit, you know, and there's just lamps and stuff all over the walls, you know, fabrics hanging from everywhere. So real comforting sort of environment. And we all sit down. And he's not there yet. Then he comes down the stairs, you know. He comes down these stairs of doom, as they call them. They're these really narrow, steep stairs. So he comes down, and I'd seen him a few years ago. It's probably been like 6 years now, maybe more. And, you know, he's thinner than he was. And he basically sits down and starts right in, you know. And he's like, so who am I? Where does this all start? I'm going to do my best to say what he said, to tell the stories he told, but, you know, obviously, they're not going to be as good as his. So he says, here's where it started. I had a book. I was living at home still, and I had this book, and I called it my truth book. And in it, I would write truths. So the first thing I wrote was, Jackie Norby has big tits. Which made me laugh, you know. I don't know. It was funny because the way he told the story, and then it's kind of like he's writing it in the book and then looking at it like, huh, Jackie Norby does have big tits indeed. Okay. You know, so then I think the next one was, I think Kirk Cameron might be queer. You know, and then he would write stuff in there like, I masturbated 3 times today and all this stuff. All these things that are, I think most people think these sorts of thoughts, you know, but rarely do they write them down. And I think a big part of it is the fear of them being discovered, right? You know, and what other, not so much discovered is what are the people who discover them going to think? So he had this book and he was trying to figure out where to keep it. So he, you know, and he was going to keep it in his car, but, you know, he had just started college and he was still living at home and his mom cleaned out his car regularly. So that wasn't an option. So he decided to keep it. He taped it. He duct taped it to the bottom of his sock drawer. So you can guess where that goes. So he tells this story about he comes home one night and he's going into the fridge to get a glass of milk. You know, it's late. And he's open, he's got the fridge open, and his dad comes rushing into the room. And he only sees him lit up by the light of the fridge. You know, terrifying. And his dad says, you need to leave and never come back, but first you need to go tell your mom you're sorry. You know, she had found his book, read the stuff in there, and that was it. You know, so shortly after that, he moved out and that was that. So it's kind of what I guess what he's talking about. You know, it's called dangerous writing, and it's sort of it is dangerous. You know, when you get close to the self, and if you're being really true, it's very scary. You know, reading something that's true is scary because think about this. Like, if you wrote a story about the worst thing that ever happened to you, let's say, you know, your most traumatic event. Then to take that and have other people read it is scary because they know that about you and they know a lot about you from how you wrote it and they're going to be critiquing it, you know, so it's hard to feel like they're not critiquing the event, right? It's a big thing. So he tells us that story and then he says he reads one of his stories called Sea Animals, which I highly recommend. Excellent, excellent story. And it's you know, based on true life. A lot of his work is very autobiographical. And it's about he had a baby brother who only lived for, you know, 77 days or something like that. He was born, he had a lot of problems and stuff. So the story's kind of about that. And he reads the story for us. And then when he's finished, you know, and you could tell when he finished, it took a lot out of him. Like, he was really sad and remembering it. And so, you know, then he tells us the parts of it that weren't true, you know, saying there's a couple things in it that aren't true, or this detail or that detail is different. And he says, fiction is the truth that tells the truth truer. So, you know, what he's saying is, you know, I don't know. Over the next couple days, that got clearer for me. Because what he's saying is, you write fiction, and if you're true to the emotion, it's not really lying. If you change the details in order for the reader to get the truth of the emotion better, you're doing the right thing, or it's okay. You know, you don't want to just... you don't want to change the emotion, but you can change the events. You know, whereas I think most people would think fiction is about changing, just making up events all over the place, and making up emotion, you know? Just all invented, all whatever. So he told us some more stories. He told us about how... So he's been sick for a long time, AIDS, and you know, so he's been living with that for a long time. And you know, his partner was there and was teaching the class and was saying how things were tough in some ways because, you know, Tom never expected to live that long. He did not think he would live to be his age as an adult man. He thought, you know, I'm sure he's seen many of his friends and contemporaries die long ago, and you know, he's still around, which is great, but I mean, it would be weird if you were 99% sure you were going to be dead by the time you were 40, and then to be 50, you'd be thinking, well, this is now what, you know? He told this story about how at one point he was really sick and he was just tired of being sick, and in the house where we were sitting, you know, he was upstairs and he just screamed fuck and threw this glass against the wall, and it was this heavy, heavy glass, and he threw it against the front door, you know, and just smashed it on the front door. And, you know, he saw his neighbor was out raking leaves, and the neighbor looked up in shock. And so after a couple minutes, he kind of calmed down. He's like, I should probably go out and apologize to the neighbor, clear this all up. So he goes out to apologize to the neighbor. He goes out of the back door, and he's coming up the patio. And, you know, he hears, like, freeze, get on the ground. And he looks down, and he's got the little red target on his chest, you know, the little red laser sight. And there's a bunch, you know, there's like a dozen guys with guns. They're all pointed at him because the neighbor had thought it was a gunshot. So he had thought that someone had shot somebody and called the cops, and the cops had ran over and were waiting to go in, and he came out, you know. So he's saying, though, the scariest part was he had this thing on his chest and all that, and the scariest part was he was thinking about how all he would have to do is make some kind of quick motion and then he would be dead. And, you know, maybe that wouldn't be so bad. It was terrible, you know. And then he said, but then I thought, they'd probably just end up shooting me in the leg and then I'd be even worse off than I am now. you know, he told this story about his mom. He was saying that, anyway, he told stories about his parents and all that. I mean, I don't know. That's not all my stories to tell. The point is, I just kind of wanted to get across, you know, and then everyone in the class read these stories that were very heartbreaking and sad, you know, because everybody wrote about these moments where their life changed and turned, and usually it was for the worse, to be honest. I don't know if anyone's story was about a redemptive, now things are going great kind of time. You know what I'm saying? Which is really too bad. But, you know, there's a lot to be learned there from the things that people wrote and the critiques they made. I mean, I just took pages and pages of notes. You know, you would tell these funny stories about other things, too, like So when Chuck Palahniuk was a student there, and Fight Club came out, and he did a reading up at Powell's in Portland. And so in Fight Club, there's a boss, the guy, the main character's boss. And Chuck Palahniuk had basically captured his boss from when he worked at Freightliner and captured him perfectly. Every detail was lifted exactly from this guy. You know, he had just was like a literary portrait in the book of this guy. So the guy, the Freightliner boss who was captured, shows up to the reading, you know, and Chuck Palahniuk does the reading, and it's the part with that guy in it and everything. And so then after the reading's over, the boss comes up to Chuck Palahniuk, and he says, you know, I had a boss just like that guy once. Like, you gotta be fucking kidding me, right? You don't even recognize that you were the boss in that thing. You know, that's not, you don't even recognize that was you, you know? So it was a long weekend. And, you know, I was just exhausted every night. I would leave my hotel at 8:30. I would get back at 11. And I would walk back and, you know, redo the piece that I was working on in my mind. And they didn't actually ask for a lot of changes, you know, which was very flattering. I really liked it a lot. And it was, so on Sunday, we got out early. We were going to meet on Monday. You had to read out loud to the entire group one of the first days, and then on Monday we were all going to make come back and read our revised versions. So you know, on Sunday I get out and I ran over to the library. I had all the revisions I wanted to make ready, so I quickly, you know, jammed it in on the keyboard and printed them out, and I had 16 copies and all that. So go on my merry way, and I'm walking home, going past all the craziness in Portland, and then I'm thinking about it still and thinking like, oh shit, I should have put this in there and this and that. So by the time I do that for a while, I decide I need to do another draft. So I had to find this independent publishing resource center and go there and figure that all out. And ultimately it was, you know, 2 hours of walking and finagling and stuff for to change maybe 12 words or something like that. But I don't know. I was glad I did it. You know, I think that was they were good changes, and fuck it. Had to be done. So anyway, I don't know. I mean, I could talk about this for days and days, you know, what an experience it was. I'm trying to think of, you know, something that really summed it all up for me, you know. But I think at the end, at the end, he talked a little bit after, you know, and I have to say, you know, I don't want to just talk about me. I'm not really, an hour five of this podcast, I don't want to talk about me. I just mean, you know, about, I don't want to be self-complimentary. That's not an easy thing for me to do. He really liked what I did, and he really made a point of saying he thought it was excellent and to try and submit it to some places and all that. And to have, like, you know, to have your hero say that about, you know, that'd be like if you were a chef who really idolized Gordon Ramsay, and he comes to your restaurant, he says, "It's delicious, well done, fresh, perfect, perfectly seasoned." And you think, oh my God, you know, I mean, it's the highest compliment. Because, you know, I don't know, people say nice things, but I just, you don't know who they are. I mean, what's the background there, you know? But, you know, if you're working on something, like writing, it's hard to know. It's hard to know whether you're doing a good job. And it's hard to know, you know, sometimes you think, oh, this is something I wrote when I was 20. Maybe I'm losing my touch. You know what I mean? Maybe I lost it. Maybe my best years are behind me. So it was really good to go to that, and then to hear some of the other pieces and think that's a lot like something I would have written when I was 20, in way, you know, in good and bad. You know, that you just have a different way. So it was just, I mean, it's one of the, although I didn't make many of the 30 before 30 things, I didn't know this would be even an option, and having done it is one of the, it's one of the top experiences of my entire life, I have to say. So at the end of the workshop, he kind of, you know, gave a little talk, and he just said, you know, he's like, you know, I most of the time I come down here in the basement, I just throw my laundry, my dirty laundry down the stairs, or, you know, and then I'll come down here once a week and kick my dirty shorts across the room to the washer and kind of just look over at this table and, you know, say, huh, yeah, that's there, you know. And, but he's saying, you know, I don't sleep very well anymore, and I'm up a lot at night. And so sometimes, you know, with the lights all on here and everyone here, what I don't tell you is that, you know, I take a piece of each of you and, you know, put it into something on this table. And sometimes when I can't sleep at night, I'll come down here and turn on the lights and just, you know, think about this and think about the workshops and all the people who've come through here. And, you know, and he said, and this is, you know, this is my home and this is my life. So it was all, it was very touching, you know, and I was a goddamn raw nerve. I'll tell you that for the next 3 or 4 days. I mean, I'm starting to come back around, but holy shit. On Wednesday, I go out for breakfast and I go to this place and they have, they had the silverware wrapped up in napkins and then holding it together was a twist tie. You know, they twist tied them shut to keep them tight, I guess. So I'm untwisting this twist tie, and then I'm thinking about, you know, I'm just thinking about as I'm untwisting it how I've never bought a twist tie, you know, in my life. This was something that when I was at home, we just always had. It was just always around. And then you move out, and then you don't buy things like that, and it's just gone, you know, and it's like a small thing, but it's one of those things that you just think, Jesus Christ, you know, this used to be every day I would be fucking around with a twist tie, making my lunch for school or whatever, and I haven't touched one in, you know, 15 years. I've never bought one, and I've never, you know, I don't know, it was just a small thing where you think about, you got this twist tie, and it's not about twist ties, you know, although it's a pretty nice invention. Simple. Anyway. Simple, elegant solution for many problems. But it just makes you think about what are the other things that you've probably left behind that you've never even thought about or that you'll never remember. You know what I mean? They're gone. They're just gone. And, you know, the experiences you've had or things like that that you just can't remember. Or there's no cause to remember. There's no trigger for some things anymore. And then you just lose that part. And you also lose, you know, it's like the whole comfort of home. I mean, there are parts of it that you can never get back. You can never recapture some of those feelings, I think. So anyway, yeah, so, you know, I almost started weeping at this breakfast place. Thank God I didn't, because if someone had asked, I'd have to explain, like, well, it's sort of about this twist tie, but really it's about a whole bunch of other shit. Yeah, I don't really want to get into it, but you know, there's a lot going on. So I guess this is a little self-indulgent, but what part of this isn't, right? So maybe what I'll do is go ahead and read the thing I wrote, if you guys think that's a good idea, to sort of cap off this hour. This is about a time from about a year ago. It was right after my grandmother had passed away. And, you know, it's mostly true. There's some fiction that tells the truth truer in here. So this is, you know, and there's still some revisions to be made, but this is the version I read last week. It's called Tough Shoot. Manhattans. The first ingredient in a Manhattan vermouth in its heavy, full bottle, bought special for tonight, comes down from the cabinet. My mom, my brother, my girlfriend, all of them waiting, sitting on the huge couch that takes over my apartment, stretching out from the far wall, curving around until it's flush with the front door frame. Its skin covered up with clean blankets, cushions rotated over and over like the balding tires on an old car. This is all my mom's idea, a surprise. She's never been much for drinking. She'll pick out a six-pack when my brother visits at Christmas, and if he doesn't kill off the lot, the remainders will wait out the next year, stuffed into her fridge right next to hummus and homemade oil and vinegar. Her lonely lady fridge, the kind crowded with everything but real food. Manhattans, my grandmother's drink. Today, she's gone. Her body gone. Machines in the hospital and calls and calls and calls. Then nothing. Too much, then gone. Bourbon is next. Warm brown in the way of borrowing a stranger's coat after she's had it on a while. The warmth needles your skin back to life, and you hate how much you hate how in love you are with something that easy. The bourbon off to the side, hiding behind the full vermouth. No need for Mom to see how me and bourbon are getting on. We used to take my grandmother to the Black Knight, the only steakhouse in town. So dark and smoky, the salads had a bitter crunch. My grandmother hooked her cane on the edge of the table, leaned back in her seat. Her Manhattan showed up in a squat lowball glass with a heavy bottom. Some places will serve a Manhattan in a martini glass, but that's a newer thing, fashionable. Not so much a Black Knight thing. I'd ask for the maraschino cherry cased in the drink's amber. Those cherries bit into me. The liquor so strong, crawling off the cherry and cutting through my tongue, drilling at my teeth, sluicing into the pockets of my cheeks until the sharp candy of the cherry came to my rescue. The liquor too much, then gone. Maraschino cherries, the last ingredient. A cherry into each of four shot glasses, all from different states. Then two parts bourbon, one part vermouth. Dash of bitters, stir in ice, and then pour. Arizona, Utah, Wyoming, Illinois. Not the usual way, the shot glasses. But this isn't a crowd of drinkers. The usual way doesn't call for mixing in a touch of cherry juice either. But again. Handing Wyoming to my mom, our thumbs together on the side sit too thick for the short glass. I set the glass down on the table and she picks it up. Our thumbs together too much. My brother is Utah. He wipes his finger and thumb through the corners of his mouth. Arizona for my girlfriend, her teeth over her bottom lip. The only person who gets away with calling that a smile. We say things we remember about my grandmother. Things we want to remember. How she took us to stupid kid movies. How she would take us to anything just so long as we promised it wouldn't be so bad as Bill and Ted's bogus whatever. How sometimes she would laugh at the movies, her old woman laughs racking through the theater like shotgun blasts over a lake. How she was ever stopping herself from saying shit. How she'd say shoot instead if she caught herself. How she didn't always catch herself and ended up saying things like bullshoot or tough shoot. How she took my mom for her first drink at the Millionaires Club, a place about as likely to host a millionaire as the Black Knight would be to host King Arthur. The four of us hold up our glasses, then sip. Bottoms up, Arizona. Cheers, Utah. Salut, Wyoming. Prost, Illinois. My mom. The liquid hits her lips and my mom wraps her hand over her eyes and weeps. Ugly crying. Her eyes covered. Her lips pulled tight. She's teeth all the way back. Crying so that she forgets herself. Forgets her mother's drink. I lift my palm up underneath her glass to take it away from her fingers while she shakes. The smell, the taste, too much, then gone. Me and my brother sit close in and put our hands on her back. We don't know what to do with our hands, our touch. We never figured it out. Holding my mom while she cries, hugging my brother. We're the brothers sharing hugs at the airport drop-off with all the grace and warmth of grade schoolers, forced to make up after a fistfight. Both boys still tasting playground gravel. My brother's ribs through his shirt when we hug. My mom's back so small. My girlfriend given up on asking for my hands. Given up on pulling my hands to her stomach. To the roundest parts of her legs. To her face. Given up on touch. It's not enough. It's too much. Then it's gone. We try. No tissues in the apartment, so it's toilet paper for Mom. She cries it out on the couch, its cushions bolstered by cardboard slabs wrapped in towels. cries into toilet paper on her son's curb couch. It's over after a few rips at the toilet roll. She can finish up a cry. She's tough shoot. Then they leave, all of them. Leave me and my sticky liquor fingers and a red cherry ring on the counter. Leave me and the couch and all four shot glasses just about full. Cherry's gone, just like my grandmother's Black Knight Manhattans. But she's not here to finish the job. Tough shoot, Manhattans. Lined up on the counter. Too much. To Arizona. To leaving it on the table. Leaving half a smile and all of a drink. Bottoms up. To the time you chipped my tooth, Utah. Cheers. To Wyoming. Motherless. Land of surprises. Encrusted hummus. Salut. To Illinois. For its heartland. To me. For mine. Prost. The end. So that's my story. That's my workshop story. I hope you enjoyed it. You know, there's some more edits to make, and then, you know, post it somewhere. Maybe send it out, and if it doesn't get anywhere, then I'll just post it on my own website. And you all can enjoy reading it, I guess. Some guests coming in pretty soon, so we're going to take a quick break. Here. Sorry. Take a quick break and be back in just a little bit. Let's come back, huh? looking for a glass here. Further I fall. Gonna pour myself a shot of whiskey here. Black Canyon. I think I got this for my birthday from Val last year. That's almost gone. You know, at this workshop, the two other things were about the two big things I learned, I think, about what I need to do. There are two times you really need to slow down a story, any story. And it's if someone enters or leaves a room or passes through a doorway. And any time people touch. You know, and the thing that Tom said was, you know, we're all touched so little that it's important to slow those moments down. So, you know, I'm going to pour this out here and let's have a drink. Let's have a drink for Tom Spanbauer, huh? Forever. Oh, okay. And then I'm going to tell you about my mausoleum visit here. So as part of this whole adventure to Oregon, Portland, one of the places I've always wanted to visit was the Portland Memorial Mausoleum. This is, you know, Chuck Palahniuk wrote this book called Fugitives and Refugees, and it's kind of a guidebook to Portland, which is, it's very readable. And if you're headed that way, check out the book, because he talks about some pretty good spots. And here's the other thing I learned, by the way. This is like my fourth or fifth time there, but I hadn't really explored as much on the east side of the river as I did this time. You know, I spent a lot of time and walked over the bridges a lot. It's good to have, you know, I would look at things as like, let's try and cluster things I want to do in a geographical area and do them all. But it's good to have something that takes you out into the boonies. Because that's when you find other shit and you end up doing other... You know, the city out there, which I'm completely in love with, what's great is, you know, there's stuff in the neighborhoods. You know, they'll have a neighborhood bar, a neighborhood coffee shop, or something crazy. So, you know, if you go from one place to the other, you're bound to pass five or six things of interest. So there's this mausoleum out there that used to be owned by the city. And you could go there, and he described it a lot as an interesting place, you know, and it's weird. It's eight floors, but the main floor as you walk in is like the fifth floor, and you go down underground to the, you know, first, second, third, fourth, or you can go up to the eighth. Very weird place. And my first encounter with this place was in the novel Survivor. That's what I was trying to find, by the way, while I was screwing around. Here we go. I'm going to just read like a paragraph or two, don't worry. According to my daily planner, I'm trying to keep my balance. I'm up at the top of a ladder with my arms full of fake flowers, roses, daisies, delphiniums, stock. I'm trying to keep from falling, my toes curled up tight in my shoes. I'm collecting another polyester bouquet, an obituary from last week all folded up in my shirt pocket. The man I killed last week is around here somewhere. What's left of him? The one with the shotgun under his chin, sitting alone in his empty apartment, asking over the phone for me to give him just one good reason not to pull the trigger. I'm sure enough going to find him. Trevor Hollis. Gone, but not forgotten. Resting in peace. Called from this life. Or he's going to find me. That's what I always hope. Up at the top of the ladder, I must be 20, 25, 30 feet above the gallery floor while I pretend to catalog another artificial flower. My glasses pinching at the end of my nose. My pen leaves words in my notebook. Specimen number 786, I'm writing, is a red rose around 100 years old. What I hope is everybody else here is dead. Part of my job is I have to arrange fresh flowers around the house where I work. I have to pick flowers out of the garden I'm supposed to tend. What you need to understand is I'm not a ghoul. The petals and calyx of the rose are red celluloid. First created in 1863, celluloid is the oldest and least stable form of plastic. I'm writing in my notebook. The leaves of the rose are green-tinted celluloid. I'm writing and look over my glasses. Down at the end of the gallery and so far away, she's just a tiny black outline against a huge stained glass window with somebody. The stained glass is a picture of somewhere. Sodom or Jericho or the Temple of Solomon being destroyed by fire in the Old Testament, silent and blazing. Twisted feathers of orange and red flame twist around falling blocks of stone, pillars, friezes, and out of this walks a figure in a little black dress, getting bigger as she gets close. And what I hope is she's dead. My secret wish is right now to be romancing this dead girl. A dead girl. Any dead girl. I'm not what you'd call choosy. The lie I tell people is I'm doing research into the evolution of artificial flowers during the Industrial Revolution. All this is supposed to be my thesis for Nature and Design 456. Why I'm so old is I'm a graduate student. The girl has long red hair that women only have these days if it's part of some orthodox religion. From up so high on my ladder, the thin, bendable little arms and legs of the girl make me look again and again and wonder if someday I could be a pedophile. Although not the oldest specimen in my study, this rose I pretend to examine is the most fragile. The female sex organ, the pistil, including the stigma, the style, and the ovary, are cast jet. The male sex organ, the stamen, including a wire filament topped with a tiny glass anther. Part of my job is I have to grow fresh flowers in the garden, but I can't. I can't grow a weed. The lie I tell myself is I'm here to gather flowers, fresh ones for inside the house. I steal the fake flowers for sticking out in the garden. The people I work for only look at their garden from inside, so I stick the bare dirt full of fake greenery, ferns or needlepoint ivy. Then I stick in fake seasonal flowers. The landscaping is beautiful as long as you don't look too close. The flowers look so lifelike, so natural, so peaceful. The best place to find bulbs for forcing is in the dumpster behind the mausoleum. Thrown away are plastic pots of dormant bulbs, hyacinths and tulips, tiger and stargazer lilies, daffodils and crocus, ready to take home and bring back to life. Specimen number 786, I write, occurs in the vase of crypt 2387 in the highest tier of crypts, in the lesser south gallery on the seventh floor of the Serenity Wing. This location, I write, 30 feet above the floor of the gallery, might account for the almost perfect conditions of this rose, found on one of the oldest crypts in one of the original wings of the Columbia Memorial Museum. Then I steal the rose. So that's the mausoleum in the book. You know, this is a book I read when I was working at Cerebral Palsy all these years ago. Call people up, I'd say, "Hi, this is Peter from Cerebral Palsy. We're calling to see if you had any resaleable household items or clothing that you'd like to make available for pickup." And then they'd say no or fuck you and all that. I met Chuck Palahniuk one year, and I told him that. You know, I was like, I read this while I was working this. So he signed it, "Peter, 123, don't call me, Chuck Palahniuk." I also have a tattoo that's from a quote in this book. So this is a big book for me. And this all really ties into, you know, this whole workshop thing and all this stuff. You like how I'm becoming a tough man again? I'm like, you know, this workshop thing, whatever. I'm a tough man. I'm a hefty tough sack. So I've been wanting to go to this place. So here's the thing. Since recent history, since he wrote this book, the mausoleum is no longer owned by the city. It is owned by a private funeral company. So you can't just go there. You know, it's like, you can't just go visit. You can't walk in and be in there. Which is, you know, was a huge disappointment for me. But this time I decided not to let it bring me down, right? I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do some genealogical research, find someone who's buried in there, and pretend I'm a distant relative. Come to pay my respects. So I look up on Find a Grave, all this shit. Before I left, I did this. I planned this. And then, of course, I forgot my, you know, I'm walking to the mausoleum and I had forgotten my slip of paper. So I said, shit. So I go to Find a Grave and you can search by funeral home, right? So I look up the mausoleum and then I think, well, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just look for the name Peter, because that seems very believable if, you know, if there's any questioning about my story. So I look up Peters, and there's Peters. There's one named Peter Yerst. I'm like, yeah, that sounds kind of like a weird version of Dirk. That's pretty close. Guy's from the Midwest. And there's this whole thing written in the Find a Grave from his great-granddaughter, who, you know, also has some kids that would be my age. So I'm like, perfect. I write all this down. I head in there, you know, and I write down he's in a Wilson East F tier 1 Crypt 24. I'm like, this is going to be perfect. So I'm walking over there, and I get this brainstorm too, where I'm like, you know what maybe I should do before I bust out and be like, hello, I do belong here, is just act like I do. So I go to the grocery store and I buy some flowers. You know, I wish I'd had more. I go there and I ask the lady working in the flower section, I say, I'm going to visit a grave. What kind of flowers do people bring to a grave? Because I don't even know. You know what I mean? This is not something I've done. I think I even said to her, you know, I'm a little out of my depth here. What do you recommend? And she's like, I don't know. These are good. These are good. She said, you know, these are good for, these are good. These will last a long time if they don't really have water. She's like, well, they have water. And I'm like, no. But the truth is, I have no fucking idea. Maybe. Maybe. So I buy the flowers, and then I take the bus to the funeral home. I wore black pants instead of jeans and a nice sweater. You know, I when I packed my bag, I planned this outfit, you know, so that when I got to the funeral home, I'd be ready to go. And so I go in the front door, and I'm standing there. There's a lady there. You know, she looks exactly like, I wish I could remember this actress. But she's like the secretary type act, you know, typical central casting for secretary. And she's sitting at the desk, and she's got a sign-in sheet there. So I kind of just start signing in, you know, and then she says, okay, I'll buzz you in. And I say, I had to admit at that point, I was like, which way do I go? She says, okay. And, you know, I said, I'm actually from out of town. So which way? She's like, across the courtyard, and then I'll buzz you in. So you cross this courtyard. She looks out the window, and you hit the door, buzzes you in. So then I'm in the mausoleum. I'm in. I did all this work. She didn't even ask. You know, I think there's a space on which grave you're visiting. So I put Peter Yerst, you know. And then I just walk right in. There was no questioning it. So I don't know if this is maybe, you know, some doors as you turn 30 perhaps are open to you, such as visiting a crypt. So for all of you interested in visiting a mausoleum, congratulations, once you turn 30, no one really thinks that you're just there because you're a, you know, weird alt kid who's into Chuck Palahniuk and all this shit. So I go in, and it's everything I'd hoped for. I got to be honest. Very quiet. There was one other person I saw the entire time was a guy working there, you know. Saw him on one floor. So I have no idea how to get around. You know, you get in there, and you can get lost immediately. The whole thing is just lined with crypts, I guess you'd call them. You know, it's like a grid. Each one is like a marble slab with a vase on it, and it says the person's name and when they lived and when they died. Some of them have flowers, some of them don't, you know. And as described, he described this. He did an interview with The Advocate, Chuck Palahniuk, and it was like how people would leave things, you know, for their route. Like, what was nice about this crypt, here's the thing. It was a weird mixture. It made sense that this was like a city-owned entity because it was very old. It was like 60s, 70s. There is, you know, green carpet in there, which is clean and vacuumed, but still, there is a sofa in there that is like lime green and brown striped. You know what I mean? The furniture does not match. It's all over the place. It's exactly the kind of furniture you would hope to find at a thrift store. It screams thrift store. But here's the thing. I don't think it's from a thrift store. I think it was publicly bought in the 60s or 70s and has remained there. You know, and that's what you see in the thrift stores now, is that kind of shit. But it's just been there. You know, a lot of linoleum floors. And it was weird because the crypt parts were marble, But then, you know, there's one place where it was like wooden bookshelves almost with boxes of ashes. They looked like safety deposit boxes behind glass. And, you know, the woodwork is very beautiful and all that. And then you look at the ceiling, and it's a drop tile ceiling with brown stains in it, you know? Now, there were some things there that were, you know, you'd see it, and it was sort of heartbreaking. There was one that was really bad. It was like a baby. And it had, there were all these toys and stuff right next to the crypt on the ground. And it had this note on top that said, you know, please don't steal anything from my baby. I could never give it a Christmas or a birthday, so these are all I can give my baby, are these gifts. You know, it's all sitting there still. Or there'd be things taped up. I mean, and it was weird because the things that were there for the most part were super generic and strange, but that made them almost sadder. You know, there was one that was, just an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. You know, normal printer paper and a clip art that's, you know, number one dad, and it's like the number one, but he's got googly eyes and a smile and Mickey Mouse gloves, and it says number one dad, and it's just taped to this crypt, you know? And I don't know, and you first look at that and you're just like, wow, that's, I don't know, lazy or something, but then you think about, I don't know, someone printed this out, and they put it in a folder and they kept it flat and brought it all the way here. You know, someone put some work into that. And so I start exploring the different floors, you know, because there's like the green floor with all the lime green shit and the wood. And then there's like a floor that's got a pink sofa on pink carpet in, you know, surrounded by these windows that make the whole thing pink. So I get on the elevator, oldest, scariest elevator of all time. And it's weird. The floors are named after, you know, presidents for the most part. It's like McKinley, Madison, Jefferson, Wilson, Harding, Grant. But also above the things, they have printed out label maker labels, you know. So it says in label maker, memory, and then it's McKinley, fuchsia. And then in label maker, it says peace, and then in regular Madison. And then in label maker, it's reverence, and then Jefferson. You know, the whole place felt very sort of held together over time. You know, the stairwell was just this concrete area. It had a, there was a sign in the stairwell that said fallout shelter. And then the doors to the different floors in the stairwells were just regular doors, unfinished wood. And they had apartment, the same number that I have on my apartment, you know, the number 5. It has a number 5. It's a gold background with a black block number. Just bought at a hardware store. It's just a decal, you know, stuck to the door. So parts of it were very, you know, sort of just put together. And, you know, on one side of the building, there's a huge mural. And there's a fountain inside. You know, there's all this stuff. I mean, it was just, you know, it felt like miles of crypts, you know, and dead bodies. And the whole place is just this big concrete block. But in the same time, it felt sort of alive in there, you know, because there were these crypts where people had put all this stuff up or done all this decoration. You know what I mean? So in some ways, I really thought it was a nice place, a final resting place, because, you know, it seemed like people were visiting regularly to some of the graves, and it seemed like, I don't know, people are leaving things. Here's what I don't like. We have a graveyard out here that's intersected, you know, the highway goes right past it, and so does a busy street in town. And it's just this flat grass thing. There's no fence. There's no trees on the outside. You're just listening to trucks go shooting by while you're looking at the grave. And it's one of these graveyards that I think this is a newer thing where there are no headstones. They're all the kind that are plaques buried in the ground so that these assholes can mow the graveyard easier. You know what I mean? And it's just like, if you're going to go to the effort of giving someone a final resting place, why not have some class to it? You know what I mean? Give them a headstone or, I don't know, if you put them in this mausoleum, it's like, I don't know, why not tape a number one dad to the side? You know what I mean? Why not go there? Why not make it happen? I mean, this is your fucking dad, right? This guy you care about. Do it. Be an adult. Anyway, It was, and here's the thing. So looking through the mausoleum, I did feel, it felt a little bit intrusive for a while, you know, because I was thinking, ah, this is weird, you know, like there would be, here's the ones that got to me, you know, and there's no reason for this to get to me, but, you know, Peter Yurst is dead in like 1920. So I'm thinking, all right, well, he was dead 60 years before I was born. But, you know, some of them were people who died recently and some of them were died when they were 13 or something like that. So I started thinking, man, I don't know, maybe this is wrong, you know, and I took some pictures. But this is probably going to sound really lame. Maybe I just convinced myself of this and will feel like an asshole down the road. But, you know, between this book and this workshop and all this thing, I mean, I feel like there is a whole side of me that was born in this place in a weird way without really knowing it. And it's sort of always occupied, you know, for some, this would be like for some people if they could go to Narnia, you know, some place that was just completely inaccessible and not possible to reach. And I got to go to Narnia. My Narnia, I was there. Pretty amazing stuff, I gotta say. And if you ever are in Portland, I highly recommend this. Wilhelm Mausoleum. Now, if this is for some reason illegal or whatever, I didn't do this. But if you dress semi-nice and you walk in with some flowers like you are supposed to be there, they will give you no hassle and you can walk around and experience for yourself. You know, experience, it's damp in there. It's bizarre. It's nice and also horrible. I think it's an experience that if you're the kind of person who would appreciate that sort of experience, do it. You have to do it. If you're not, fuck it. I don't know. I don't know what you do. Go to a Gap or something, whatever. Buy a new handbag on vacation. I really don't know what, I criticize other people, but I'm like, I don't know. I'm criticizing people for buying a handbag on vacation. Meanwhile, I'm just explaining the benefits of going to a fucking mausoleum where, you know, dead daddies are buried. So, you know, whatever. Take my advice with a pinch of salt, right? All right. I'm expecting some guests here in about 5 minutes. So I think what we're going to do is take a break and then come right back, right? Take a break and then we'll see some new faces through their voices in just a moment. We're going to try and give my sister a quick call before these guests show up. Let's see if we can do it. See if she picks up. So far, nothing. Hello? Are you there?
Hello?
Hey, you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? Hang on just one second. Oh, my God. Okay, I'm back. I think. This time for sure. A lesser radio man would have cut some of that out.
Hello again, birthday boy.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing quite well. How are you?
Good. Happy birthday to me.
Yeah, you're 30, you old fart.
I'm so old. Can you believe it?
You're so old.
I'm
yeah,
old.
I can believe it.
You can, yeah.
You're the oldest, except for Ian.
That's true. I'm the oldest man, except for our older brother, who's slightly older.
At least, at the end of the day, however old you feel, you know that Ian's older.
That's true. It's going to be really tough for me someday, like if, let's say, God forbid, he breaks his hip or something. Because then I'll be oh, shit, we're old. Oh, God.
Yeah, at least I have the whole, you know, like 7 years younger thing. That's splendid for me. The greatest thing that ever happened was being the youngest sister.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad it's working out well for you.
Oh, man. Have you had a happy birthday?
It's pretty good so far. I've just been podcasting all day.
Woo! Are we broadcasting now?
Yeah. You are on the radio-ish.
Hell yeah. Fuck all my haters.
Oh, do you have haters?
I don't know. It just seemed like a cool thing to say.
Yeah, it does seem like a radio thing to say, right? Fuck all the haters.
I don't think I have that many, but if I do, fuck them.
I usually say, you know, like, fuck the listeners, which are people who I think like me, but I just I just kind of assume that the haters aren't even listening, so I just go with that.
Oh, man.
I know. Well, someone's got to receive the hate rays, right?
Right.
I can't just
exactly.
shoot them out
definitely.
Into nothing.
Yeah. No, definitely. You can't just send the hate out emptily
no.
to the expansive world. You have to, you know, send it to a target, have it be absorbed, feel your hate being absorbed.
Yeah. Oh, it's a necessary part. Yeah. It's not just about expressing hate. It's about hurting somebody. Yeah.
This is not how we think. This is not a normal conversation for us.
No?
Let's be the wisdom.
What's our normal conversation like?
How was the last month?
Yeah. How was your last month? How
was
October?
Was
what did you dressed as a Zoolander thing, right, for Halloween?
Yeah, and everyone thought I was Kesha.
God damn it.
I covered my body in trash, and I was totally derelict, and I did crazy, amazingly immaculate, perfect face paint, and I put my hair up, and I covered it in some blue, but not enough, and the blonde was still shining through, and I think I just, like, have some sort of Kesha vibe, which I'm really trying to shake, but...
Yeah. From what little I know of Kesha,
like,
that's
I'd
not...
I'd say six different people over the course of the night were like, great Kesha costume.
Nice.
Like, fuck you, I'm Zoolander.
Who addresses Kesha?
And then
Kesha?
They'd laugh and be like, oh, I do get it. That's also a good costume, but you look like Kesha.
That makes no... Why would you... That's like when people dress as Lady Gaga, and it's like, for her, every day is Halloween. So that's not really... You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it's not like... I don't know.
Never dresses Kesha. Like,
why would anyone dress it? Like, woke up in the morning.
Yeah, seriously.
Oh, she's just so great. Yeah.
Oh, man. If nothing else, it's like the morning after walk of shame. Perhaps I've accidentally dressed as Kesha, but that's just because my pantyhose ripped, not because
I
intended it. No one does that. Certainly no Dirk.
No. You know, did I tell you I had some kids? So, like, the worst thing, I'm at the library, and these teenagers come up to me, and they're like, you look just like this guy, and they have a CD. And I'm like, oh, fuck, who's it going to be? And it was Elton John. They had this Elton John CD. They're like, you look just like this guy. I was like, oh, Christ.
No, you don't. That's just rude. Why would somebody say that to you?
I don't know. I was like, why did you guys go out of your way to hurt my feelings like that?
I promise it's not just because it's your birthday, but you really do not look like Elton John.
You know what I think it is?
Where you came from.
We both have kind of the five head, so I think that's probably the biggest factor.
Oh, no. I think it's because you're so gay. No, I'm just joking.
That's probably it, too. I was having sex with a man at the time, so I could see why. Yeah. And talking about...
They were like, oh my God, you gay having sex with a man naked right now? Looks like Elton John.
Yeah, and I was like, hey, whoa, that's offensive. I was writing a song about Princess Diana, so I could... looking back, I could see why they made the comparison. Who's really at fault there, you know?
No, let's see. Who do you actually look like?
Oh, do we have to do this?
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
Do you know who you look like? You look like Joseph Gordon-Levitt a little bit.
I heard this a lot more when I was younger. I think I looked more like him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I heard that a lot.
And I just pulled that out of my ass.
You know
what it is?
No.
It's that I'm always surprised that he has nice abs, and I'm shocked when you have nice abs, and I see, like, a weird random Facebook photo, and I'm like, oh, God, like, that's my brother, and he's not wearing a shirt, and he looks fit. Like, move this picture away. You're not allowed to be, like, aesthetically pleasing in any manner to anyone, ever.
Yeah, no, I'm You're sorry. Ugly. I apologize. You know what? I'll try and pump up over the next year.
You know. God damn your long runs.
Yeah, right?
Healthy eating.
Ruining it for my... I never considered the effects on my sister. There should be a thing on Facebook where if you identify people as members of your family, and then it does... You know how it has that thing where it can identify faces? It identifies that you're shirtless or in a bikini, and then it just cuts those out of your family feed. Because it's like, I don't need to see that.
Yeah, definitely.
Although
I am glad that you're not, like, obese, so, you know.
Well, thanks,
I'm
happy with that decision, too. I would have missed out on some great pictures of our brother at Burning Man, though, which I... That is my favorite Facebook photo album of 2013.
Oh, my God.
That was crazy.
So good. And the thing is that I think that it was, like, really a monumentally... important experience for him as well.
I'm not mocking him at all. I was like, this is great.
No, but it's interesting because he doesn't really post anything on Facebook. Like,
no,
I know. I'll even, like, tag him in wonderfully emotional statuses that if I said those to him, he would, like, his only response would be to open his arms and hug me.
Mm-hmm.
And he won't even like them. He won't give acknowledgement that he's ever seen them because it's Facebook. But that experience for him was one of heightened reality, and he put it on Facebook, and it, like, heightened his Facebook reality. I think there's a lot of parallels there.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't even go that deep. I was just like, this is fucking insane. Look at this stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, you had a couple years away from him. I've actually lived with that shit my entire life.
Yeah.
So... I am forced to think about the Alan Burke person in a very deep way constantly. I can't even go to trite levels anymore. I try, and then all of a sudden we're talking about the meaning of life.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd never have experienced a lot of cosmic Alan, as I like to call him.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And he's so calm when he talks about it all. Whereas I am, like, the most emotional person on the planet, possibly. And so we have the same ideas, but our ability to communicate and portray them are just, like, opposite
right
plan. and examples. It's interesting though. It's interesting to be your guys' little sister. I'll say that much.
Well, hey, it's interesting having you as a little sister.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's working out so far. So far, so good.
We're doing pretty.
Yeah, no promises, but it's okay.
Hey, lots of promises. All will be kept.
Are you guys both, or are you just coming home for Thanksgiving, or what's going on with this holiday?
I am going to Long Island. It's like
Long Island,
$1,000. It's like impossible to come home for Thanksgiving. And actually, I'm going to California for Christmas, which is why we really need to talk about the next time you and I are going to see each other, because I need to see you and Ian.
Yeah, because you won't be here for Christmas.
I think the Dirk siblings got to get together somewhere, be it like Arizona, New York, Cali, Colorado, whatever. But
well,
like,
my vote is for California or New York, if those are the options.
Okay.
We could do stuff there.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, that's kind of like the deal, you know, is that this was the first year that I like relinquished my family from having to like make
a Christmas tree. So
are
you not going to see your mom on Thanksgiving?
No, my mom's coming to Cali. So you're all going there. I have a layover in Denver, and then my mom gets on the plane.
Gotcha.
And we sit next to each other going to Cali.
Gotcha.
Alan's having actual Christmas Day in Chicago with his girlfriend Lauren.
Okay.
And then he's flying back the 26th, and we're hanging out from then until New Year's all over Cali.
That sounds like a nice little family event there.
Yeah, and I haven't seen his home that he's lived in for the past couple of years that he really enjoys, and he's going to defend and maybe move soon, and... like, there's no real, like, after 4 months of being at home this year, there's no real reason for me to go home except for you and Ian.
Aww.
See you guys?
Yeah, but he's not even here either.
So if we could do that alternatively, then, we just have to make that a goal as well. And I can house you guys, I can go to where you are, whatever works.
You know what we need to do? We need to create a, like, regular holiday, like a Dirk Day. Where we look up, like, when's the cheapest time of year to travel? And then we figure that out, and then we just rotate where we're going.
Definitely.
Because I don't think that unless it's a little regimented, it just doesn't happen for us.
Right, yeah. Traditions, and all of the normal traditions, I don't feel are going to be the most productive.
No, I don't think those are effective for us.
You know, like at the end of the day, and like seriously, I will, if it's Dirk Day, I will take the week off. Like, I'll do whatever I need to do.
Yeah.
I'll be like, you don't understand. And if anybody tries to understand or like tries to give me shit, I'll just tell them the story of our father and then we're done.
Yeah.
Like, they'll shut up.
Well, and also we could just meet somewhere like, you know, Minneapolis. Just all meet. Oh, hey, my next guest is here, so I got to go.
Okay. I love you. Happy birthday.
Love you, too.
And you'll get something in the mail within a week to a month.
Oh,
and
great.
I love you. 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 I love you.
Thank you so
Happy
much.
Happy birthday, man.
See you later.
Okay.
I love you, too. Bye.
Bye.
Just walked into the studio.
Which one?
Our friend Alec.
Do you have an opener in here?
No. It's on the side of the fridge. He's going to go get a beer opener. Yeah. I'll find some music to introduce him in. Do you think there's any songs with the word Alec in the title? Alec Eiffel by the Pixies. Let's see what happens. Nothing so far. You know what? Actually, what we probably need to do is take a quick break so I can move some files and then come right back. Oh, and I should plug in my computer to music. We'll just go out with no music, just fuzz. And we'll see you in a little bit.